want the thumbs up. We get the thumbs up. Once we get the thumbs up, we're good to go. And here we are, me, Robbie Suave, you, Christian Britschke, and another one of these days.
Yep.
It's just another day that ends in Y or whatever.
And therefore, another day for you to tell me what further abuses from federal law enforcement I've been suffering.
Well, you've decided that you've had enough, and you want to go along to get along. You want to get the G-men off your back.
Okay.
Which I understand.
Yeah. This is
it's a good strategy for you.
So you say G-men or semen?
Oh, fun stuff. Sorry. We were having an interesting conversation before they started recording. But anyway, your strategy was that you want law enforcement. You wanted to convey to law enforcement that you think our streets, America's streets, got to be safe again.
Okay.
You support what the administration is doing. So
okay, this is not a bad idea.
So you, but here's what, you got to bear with me for this. Mm-hmm. This is a little bit out there. We're taking this podcast in a fantasy and science fiction direction.
Oh, boy.
Get
ready, readers at home.
Obtained the ancient wishing stone of Xanarkand.
Okay.
The ancient wishing stone of Xanarkand, which grants wishes, but you don't know that there's a curse on this object.
Mm.
And it grants wishes.
Well, I got it from you, and you didn't tell me
that. Oops.
Once again.
Sorry, I keep letting you down here. Are you listening to me, or are you reading your phone?
No, I'm sorry.
The young people and their phones and their distractions these days. I'll get into that.
Okay.
Okay, but the ancient...
We have a high-pressure job. You know, lots of news happening all the time.
Lots of news happening, anyway, and we're going to get there.
Finish your little story.
The ancient wishing stone of Xanarkand. Mm-hmm. You said, I wish, because you're supporting law enforcement, I want there to be ice everywhere.
Oh, boy. Yep.
Ice everywhere. Isn't this a really original joke?
Yeah.
I'm probably the first one to make this connection in all of internet commentary. So you wish for ice.
Don't let me slip you up, though. Keep going. Yeah.
Oh, I like that.
Sorry, getting a little salty.
That's better. I should leave this to you. You're going to show me up on this podcast?
No.
I will send
please.
You back to the salt mines.
No, please. Oh, very good. Okay, please no.
So there's ice everywhere, but not the kind of ice you asked for. We're in this giant snowstorm. The Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, is just a giant block of ice
now.
They have failed to deal with this problem on such a level that I would actually like to spend our entire episode just talking about how badly they have mismanaged this. But we should start with the major national news story, Alex Pretty, which I haven't been able to address on any video format for reason this week because of the stupid fucking snowstorm. We had to cancel all our tapings.
I apologize about the curse, but really you've been censored by D.C. government incompetence at not clearing the roads.
Yes, it's censorship. It's probably done at the behest of Joe Biden.
Mm-hmm.
He probably ordered them to stop shoveling to make our lives worse.
Yeah, somehow he still has sway over the
somehow
locals.
Yeah. Biden returned.
The Biden crime family keeps pulling the strings.
But okay, let's address Alex Pretty on our show. This is Freed Up. Thank you for watching. Cue title card. Maybe we already did that. We are going to cue. I forgot that we had gotten Cody to do this, and of course he can do it because he can do anything. He's amazing, our director, producer, person.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to play now, and we're going to insert it in so they'll see it. You're not going to see it. You've already seen it. The second Alex Pretty video.
Oh, sure. Yep.
So let's show that one. So this was a separate encounter that he had with the immigration authorities a week before. We'll play that.
This is a moment the news movement filmed on January 13th in Minneapolis, showing a man who appears to be Alex Pretty interacting with federal immigration agents 11 days before Border Patrol shot and killed him. Our footage was analyzed by the BBC, whose facial recognition technology confirmed his identity to a 97% degree of accuracy.
So you can see in this video, I mean, he does kick out the taillight pretty aggressively.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that.
No, that's a crime.
Can't do that. That's a crime. They were right to detain him in that circumstance. I don't know if they charged him with anything. I think we don't have that information yet.
Doesn't appear so because he was. They tried to tackle him to ground. So
this is the arbitrary nature of law enforcement. You literally kick out, you damage their vehicle and nothing, and then in a different time, you're helping a woman up and they shoot you.
Right. Exactly.
These are not good.
So, yeah, outcomes. I guess just to summarize for anyone who miraculously has missed this news cycle, there was this over
another
on
man
Saturday,
killed.
Alex Preddy in Minneapolis is shot and killed by ICE officers. If you watched all the different videos leading up to the circumstances, he's there filming them. ICE agents push a woman. He tries to help her up. Then the ICE agents engage him, pepper spray him, tackle him to the ground. He has a gun in his waistband, which an ICE agent pulls from him. And then shortly after they do that, they pump like 10 bullets into his restrained and then lifeless body. Then last night, new video has emerged of Alex Preddy at a previous protest, whatever you want to call it, spitting on an ICE agent's car, yelling at them, and then eventually he kicks out the taillight. The ICE agents get out, or Border Patrol, whatever agency they're with. They don't wear identification and uniform, so it's hard to know.
It was not ICE. It was the border protection people in the second incident. I'm not sure who it was in this earlier footage.
At least some of them had like ICE division patches, according to New York Times, at least. But he kicks their taillight out. They get into a scuffle. They try to tackle him to the ground. And then they get up and, you know, there's other protesters. They fire off some pepper balls. They get up and they leave. So those are the facts that we have, right? Yes, I agree. I think it shows. Now, conservatives, in response to this new video, some of them have been explicitly saying, like, oh, this is, you know, super relevant context for how he shot 11 days later, right?
Which it's not.
Which it
doesn't
completely
change.
Not.
Like, Amy Swearer, who's been, I think, pretty reasonable on this, she's one of the, I think she left the Heritage Foundation to join the Mike Pence one,
okay,
where they're rebooting the Heritage
AAF.
Foundation with people who are a little bit more
racially tolerant.
Sure. She's saying, like, yeah, this doesn't change. I mean, this can change however you feel about him, but the use of it only matters for the shooting. This is the same case in Renee Good. Is the officer's use of deadly force reasonable from that officer's perspective? This is just what the legal standard is. You could say the legal standard's bad, it should be changed. But just when they're deciding whether it was proper or not, they're evaluating, did the officer have a reasonable fear for his life?
Right.
It could be he was mistaken. It could be any number of things. But was, in the moment, was that valid?
Right.
Which is why, you know, in the Renee Good case, you know, despite it being a bad situation, you could say, I shouldn't be there at all. You know, if he can demonstrate that, well, he really thought the car was coming at him, that it maybe that it was fine. This one, I was more angry about this one because seemed less ambiguous to me, frankly, than the Renee Good one, because they got a bunch of guys on him and he's down on the ground. And he's not. When the encounter begins, he's not like, and also because the administration lied. Like they said, he brandished a gun.
He didn't
approach them with a gun. He had a gun on him, but that's not, and then they all went and said, well, you can't have a gun at a protest. Like,
false.
Shut the fuck up. What
are
you saying?
First Amendment and Second Amendment can go perfectly well
together. I remember when the ACLU took criticism for backing off from the right, justifiable criticism from backing off after January 6th and saying, well, you know what? We're feeling a little uncomfortable with the protesters having guns.
Yeah.
And we were like, you bunch of cucks.
Yeah,
you're backing off fundamental rights.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what Scott Bessent and Kash Patel said. And
it was the easiest way to slander him. And obviously, I mean, you can understand why conservatives would reach for it, given just like the video itself is just so shocking. But no, I mean, I think like, so the legal standard is whether the officers had fear for their lives.
And again, I don't know. Maybe.
Well, this is what's
maybe it was an accident. Maybe they thought he had the gun and I don't know. I'm not like assuming bad faith, but you just can't say, well, he's a domestic terrorist and he was about to fire on us, so we had to kill him. Like,
yeah,
not true.
They lied pretty egregiously. And it's kind of remarkable, actually, that you're seeing like Stephen Miller even walk back some of his comments or be like, oh, maybe this wasn't entirely appropriate. In this
Caroline Levitt didn't defend it at all. That she was asked, well, does Trump agree with that? And she was just like, she did not say yes.
Which is kind of incredible.
Which means
right?
No.
It's kind of incredible. I mean, I think this does show like the problem with the legal standard of did the officer have some reasonable fear for his life or something? Like, on a surface level, that sounds like a fine standard to have, but you can see how it's like metastasized into this just like all encompassing justification for anything that you do, right? So again, so like just like to look at the facts again, it's like you have five or six or however many ICE agents tackle this guy to the ground. They've pulled a gun away that he was legally carrying. They pulled a gun away from him. He's, you know, hasn't gone completely limp, but he is restrained and not a threat. And then they pump him full of bullets, and you know, you can imagine all these various justifications, and some people have suggested some for why they might have reasonably feared, you know, someone yells gun, and so they think, oh my goodness, he's got a gun, I got to shoot him. Or, you know, they hear maybe there's an accidental discharge from the weapon they take off him, and so you think a shot has been fired, and so then you fire. But then what would be unreasonable is, I guess, the question, right? Where do you get to the point of where a police officer can shoot you and then be successfully prosecuted for it? And I don't know where that line is, because, I mean, you think of, I mean, I think, again, the worst case of any sort of police abuse that I can imagine was the Daniel Shaver case in Arizona, where
we've talked about it
on the program. But again, just to reiterate, as a man who committed no crime, SWAT shows up to his hotel because they think he has a gun. He's crawling and crying on the floor, getting contradictory instructions from officers. The officer guns him down, is charged, and he's acquitted, right?
Yeah.
In part because of this reasonable fear standard. And so if that's the standard, like, there's just never going to be any sort of criminal liability for a agent who takes
like
a
like if a police officer just like was driving recklessly and ran me over, and then the administration would say, well, Robbie was a domestic terrorist, he brandished a gun, and well, can't we just say it was wrong, or we're looking into it, or it was too they were jumping the gun, so to speak, on that. Now, new footage does show that I think mainstream efforts to, as is often the case, to like canonize this person and, you know, what a lovely, wonderful angel he was at all times, and he was just there to observe, and like, well, from the secondary footage, footage we saw, he was there to disrupt with, engage with negatively. He struck a police officer's car, not in a way that harmed any police officer, but you can't just smash out their lights. You can't do that. Mm-hmm. Can't do that. I don't know to some degree, you know, to what degree he's formally involved with left-wing groups or whoever are advising those tactics. If there are groups advising those tactics, they should stop. They should not encourage people to get in scuffles with law enforcement. I mean, maybe there's anarchist people, even of our own stripe, who think that's a good idea. I just don't think that's a good idea. I think that's going to get people hurt and will not create social change at all. So I disdain those in tactics entirely. But it has nothing to do with whether they were justified in shooting him.
Yeah, I mean, okay, so a couple thoughts here. So firstly, I mean, I think the way that the first video is most relevant is that it shows, again, when they do encounter someone who is violent, they don't have to just gun them down, right? Like, he was behaving violently, he was committing crimes. So, like, that shows that, you know, officers, they don't have to immediately jump, you know, and shoot someone, even when they're committing crimes, in order to protect their safety. So I think that's the first point. The second point is, I mean, individuals should I don't advocate for, you know, violence in any sense, and individuals should absolutely consider like the risks they're taking when they put themselves in these situations, when they're interfering. In some cases, they are quite literally interfering with ICE doing its things. In other instances, they're, you know, more passive and just, in fact, observers or blowing whistles or whatever. But from a political perspective, it's actually turned out to be quite successful, right? Because it's resulted in these incidents where ICE or immigration enforcement, whatever agency they're with, they overreact and they kill people. And now the administration is scrambling and apologizing and trying to pull back and figure out, you know, get control of its operation. Mm-hmm. Does that justify anything? Does it mean that it was worth two people getting shot? I don't think so, but it does. From the perspective of the protesters in Minneapolis, it's like they kind of won by doing this stuff.
I don't know. You could be right. I'm less confident that – I don't know. It's still very early. Like, we don't know how this is all going to play out yet. We don't know how this is going to affect the midterms, the overall immigration strategy.
Yeah.
Could be this now results in, you know, Tom Homan has come in, has a somewhat different philosophy for how to carry out the deportation agenda of the administration. He was actually more keen to – Stephen Miller and Kristi Noem, when I'm understanding, reading between the lines, wanted these very – they're social media people. They wanted these very public video confrontations – between ICE agents and immigrants, and they want content for social media. They want it to be showy and tough guy stuff. Tom Homan wanted to actually just get up to raise the numbers of criminal illegal immigrants who have other crimes, get more of them deported. So he wanted to go into red. He wants to work with red states because there they have local law enforcement that helps, makes the job easier, makes deportations go faster. But Stephen Miller was like, "What?" They literally had a fight about this. He said, "What are you doing, man? I want ICE agents in every Home Depot parking lot in the country."
Right.
Because he wants these show. He wants the confrontations.
He wants the show of force.
So if Trump's backing off that, I think that it's both. It's a good thing and something that might result in. I mean, you know, more people being removed from the country who there is more justification for doing. So maybe it's just all win-win. I don't know.
Yeah, or maybe not. I mean, I guess that would be the flip side is like, if you just do, you know, my views are clear on this. Like, I'm an open borders guy. Like, you know, criminal aliens, sure, kick them out, send them back wherever they came from. But everyone else, like, I don't want to see deportations. Yeah. And so, like, if the result of this, I guess, is a less showy, less, like, explicitly, like, murderous policy, but also a much more effective one of getting deportations, like, I don't know. Maybe that is a setback. I mean, this is always kind of the mitigating factor when people criticize Trump for his various authoritarian inclinations and, you know, his members of the administration for being authoritarians is, like, they're also all generally clowns and incompetents and idiots, right? Or just like so like rabid in their own beliefs and so visceral in their hatreds of the other side that they overstep all the time and can't really work with this gigantic bureaucracy that they have. Tom Homan is a little smarter and a little more competent, right? I mean, he's been an immigration official for decades now, right?
Right.
Yeah.
And when something bad happened, his impulse wasn't to start saying things he couldn't prove. He was just like, well, we're looking into it.
Right.
Just say nothing or say something basic like that.
Right.
Like if you watch seasoned law enforcement pros at press conferences or just like competent officials, they don't say things. They don't have, well, we're still investigating that. We don't know yet.
Because it does you no good.
They don't introduce wrongful information that they then have to walk back.
It does you no good because then you're on the back foot, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, in chess, you put a piece out there that's undefended and then you spend your whole time, you know, playing defense, walking everything back, and that just looks worse.
You're
right?
Pretty good at chess.
I've been playing a lot of chess.com lately with like the 10-minute rapid games.
Oh, yeah. You were telling me this. Yeah.
I'm winning more games. I wonder if this is actually making me a better chess player where, you know, it is a lot more just like focus on like, okay, what are some quick maneuvers I can do versus, you know, someone who like looks at the board and sees it 8 moves out. So
I know enough. I can do a couple cute things. I know enough basically to beat someone who knows how to play chess, like how the pieces move, but doesn't know anything about strategy. I can beat that person. I can't beat anyone who has any sort of more formal or more studied approach to the game than that. But I don't play as much as I used to. It's a good game though.
You know, it's funny. I picked it up. I started playing chess.com because I'm like, you know, I'm always just like scrolling Twitter and it's just sticking around on my phone for no end. Like I should have like when I have the tick to have the phone in my hand, I should have, you know, at least something that's like a little bit of brain power involved. And so but it's actually kind of backfired on me because now I just play chess.com all the time.
I mean, that's an intellectual thing to do.
It is an intellectual thing to do, but
sometimes
it is also...
I catch my better half just doom scrolling, you know, reels on TikTok or Instagram or whatever, like forever. And I want to take the phone and I do want to like chuck it out the window. I want to smash it like it's the taillight of a nice vehicle. I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
the way, you know, liberal wine moms feel about it.
No, I mean, I guess the problem is it is a little intellectual, but it is a time suck, right? And then secondly, I've realized that while I like to play chess, what I really like to do is win at chess. And so, like,
are you a bad loser? Do you get frustrated?
I'm not a competitive person by and large, but when it comes to playing chess, I passively submit to all your abuses, in games and beyond.
Yeah.
But no, I get mad when I lose at chess, I'm discovering. Oh. Yeah. So maybe it's not so good for me. And I have other intellectual pursuits I could be doing instead of chess, like my job or reading.
Jerking off, whatever.
Yeah, sure. That's always fun right now.
All right. Well, you know, that's been the big story for the week, this confrontation in Minneapolis. I appreciated Rand Paul's thoughts on this subject. Rand often good on a lot of civil liberties type topics. We've got some video of him being asked about it. Let's play that.
I think for people to have confidence in government and confidence in the law enforcement we have government, we have to be very honest. And I don't think it's honest to say he brandished a weapon. I don't think it's honest to say he assaulted officers. Every American's seen this video now, or most have. Everybody was snowed in for 3 days. A lot of people have seen this video. At every point in the video, he retreats. Now, I'm not saying he might not have been obnoxious. I'm not saying he might have said obnoxious things. But he films. He doesn't even obstruct the traffic. He waves a car through in the middle of this. As they approach him, he retreats. As they approach him again, he retreats. When a woman is shoved to the ground, he goes to help her up, and that's when he is grabbed from behind. At no point in time do I see an assault. And I don't think anybody in America believes he was assaulting those officers.
Yeah, good response from Rand, you know, pointing out that, again, saying what we've been saying, that you have to have an investigation. Like, mm-hmm. if a local police officer uses force mm-hmm. in a completely justifiable way, they still do an investigation.
Right.
That officer probably gets a desk duty shift while they work it out. Like, right. that's just how the system goes.
That was the immediate response from the Border Patrol chief. Is like, these guys are still on the job and we're moving them out of Minnesota, yeah, well, right? Yeah.
That's just not – they shouldn't have less accountability than local police officers. It's not – that's not a blow to law enforcement at all. I used law enforcement this past month because my scooter got stolen again.
For a third time?
Second time.
Okay. We talked about this last week. Yeah.
I have no – I can't remember who I've talked about what anymore. But I went to the police to get a police report, and they were very helpful. They even made it sound like they might – they would have tried to investigate it if I'd had happened to have camera footage from a surveillance camera, but – I don't bother with that. But I found out that I read my contract wrong with the scooter company because I thought they replaced it for free because I have theft protection. No. And I thought I was paying a $300 like deductible. Like I would have to pay $300 up front, but then that would – my monthly subscription, that would pay through that.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's a $300 charge to replace it. So I've now had to pay that twice. This is why I should never be in charge of finances. I don't read the fine print closely enough. I don't notice those things. So
well, these that's how they get you. That's how they get
these
you.
These twerps who keep stealing my scooter are actually hitting the bank of Robbie pretty hard here.
Yeah. I don't know. And they've gotten away with it. Yeah, that's unfortunate.
That. Yeah, that's where we need some enforcement.
Finally, yeah. Well, the scooter's clearly not doing them any good right now in D.C.
Yeah. I mean, I can't take it anywhere right now because of the weather. But
right. Yeah, I guess just real quick to add, like yeah, it is just on the Friday shooting. Like, it is just kind of remarkable to see the incompetence from top to bottom,
mm-hmm.
right? So, like, the administration and immediately kind of like assuming this is going to be an argument you have to win on Twitter,
mm-hmm.
even when they like have the footage that's out there. They know they should know that more footage is going to come out. Like, this was just very stupid. Even, you know, if you think they're evil, this was also just like really stupid.
People can't help but react to video that they see online. It's like it's a psychological impulse. I've learned to wait.
Yeah, but you
because
think
we've all gotten fooled so many times.
Running a federal agency, like you should have a little bit more comportment, I guess. I mean, this was I thought initially when Trump staffed his cabinet with a lot of like Fox News regulars, I thought that was actually maybe kind of smart because it's like, oh, so much is just winning the media narrative, right? And these people get his style. They'll mm-hmm. be able to kind of be good, you know, deputies or, mm-hmm. you know, grand viziers or whatever. But now I realize actually, no, that it has a failure mode that can be pretty terrible. And it's this, right? It's like you are so ride or die with the boss. You're so ready to do combat on Twitter, like J.D. Vance or, you know, Kristi Noem's not really on Twitter, but, you know.
But that's what they're – I would say that's what their viewers and supporters, that's what they're – the people they're making content for like and expect. It doesn't work on you because you're not – you know, you're not the audience for MAGA patriotism boomer stuff, right, of the people who watch conservative media. That's their audiences. I think their mistake is in thinking – but if you just pander to those people, you will succeed. You will go viral. Your content will do well.
Right.
But that coalition is not broad enough to win the general election for the nation reliably. You need to branch out to do that. And I think that is the big indictment of the approach they've had. This is not a – this is a –
they're playing to the fans.
They are playing to the merchandise purchasers.
Yeah.
They are playing to people
the
who are going to the reunion tour. They are not playing to the casual listener who got sick of Democrats and was listening to what the other side has to offer. Those people are – clearly repelled by this.
Yeah.
So I think that's the problem. High on their own supply type deal.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's, that, I think that's pretty sharp analysis.
Yeah.
But I just, the one other thing I would add real quick is like, I mean, just the people on the ground doing this stuff are also kind of incompetent, right? Like there was a Clint Klippenstein, journalist, independent journalist. Yeah. Yeah. I'm really surprised at just how many, like, he's very well sourced with the administration, despite being a very progressive guy.
Yeah.
But he just, he published like a lot of anonymous interviews with ICE and Border Patrol officers and like, you know, in their group chats or whatever, had some of that commentary too. And even the ICE agents are like, what the fuck are these guys doing?
Mm-hmm.
You can't just like hold them on the ground. There's six of you guys.
So
like when you've lost, when ICE has lost the ICE agents, that's no good. It will be interesting to see, I guess, how this plays politically, because people do like hate immigration, right? This is like, there
they
was some polling recently where it's like, this is still like Trump's approval ratings are pretty underwater, but like it's the Greenland stuff and things like that. Like they'd still, like, he's above water.
His best,
when it comes,
issue
is border security.
Yeah.
And I remember at the very beginning of the very first Trump administration, do you remember the travel ban or the Muslim ban, whatever you want to call it? It was just like right when he came into office, they immediately said, you know, a number of, you know, Muslim countries were suspending all visas immediately. And there was a bunch of, you know, panicked news stories, you know, justifiably in a lot of cases, of like people had a green card and now they're not able to come back. This is you know, ACLU attorneys were rushing to the airports. It was this big fanfare. Even a lot of conservatives who would later become pretty stalwart Trump supporters were like, this is out of control. What is happening here? And then some polling came out and was like, 50-50. So on this issue, this is pundit fallacy, or do you assume your views are everyone else's views?
I never do that. So. I do the opposite. I assume my views are broadly despised, and then I'll be pleasantly surprised if I turn out to be wrong. On the ICE agents themselves, it's interesting what you say. We talked about this on Rising this week. There was a liberal commentator on CNN, Tiffany Cross.
Really? A liberal commentator on CNN, okay.
Tiffany Cross, formerly of MSNBC. And, you know, CNN has been doing, I actually think, really good panels with people. You know, they've got people of all sorts of ideological stripes to argue with each other. Tiffany Cross says, she says a bunch of things. She says the other guy is trying to make like an even keeled point, there's right wing violence, there's left wing violence, mm-hmm. there's Republicans have been targeted, Democrats mm-hmm. have been targeted, it's all bad, you know. That's good stuff. I like that. I'm mm-hmm. for that. I'm pro that kind of both sides, because it's true.
Mm-hmm.
I hate the grotesque. Every time someone does something violent or extreme for even tangentially politically motivated reason, mm-hmm. then we have to go through histrionics as their side mm-hmm. says, oh look, mm-hmm. this proves that it's only left-wing extremists who do this. Oh no, this, it proves that it's only, if you watch Tucker Carlson, only you're the one who doing all the violence. It's just, and it's silly because it's the smallest category of violence anyway. Like
right.
most people are committing violence against their like neighbors or spouses or their office, you know, their workplaces.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Uh-oh. Where's that 3D printed gun we have?
It's probably in the corner somewhere.
Yeah.
But she said, so that's what the other guy said. And then she comes back with like, well, no, Charlie Kirk was killed by a right wing guy. And
wow.
Like, you still think that?
That's incredible.
They still think that.
That's really incredible.
The guy confessed to his transgender lover that he killed him because he didn't like his anti-trans hate.
Yeah, so, typical MAGA extremists.
The only people who don't accept that, I guess, are like leftists and Candace Owens, who thinks those are fabricated and
by Israel.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that was interesting. But then she was also talking about Tiffany Cross, the ICE agents. She's saying they're all Proud Boys, and she knows that because she's seen their tattoos.
Okay.
And their white nationalist tattoos. The failure rate of liberals identifying tattoos and confidently expressing that they're white nationalist is like a, is 100% failure rate.
That is just nothing. It's like a minefield if every square inch is mines, right? Yeah. For a liberal journalist to look at some tattoo and try to determine if it makes someone a fascist or not has always failed.
It's the
everywhere.
Is this X meme, and yeah. it's just like a cross. Right. It's like the Pope statue. It's Pikachu over there in the corner.
Known white supremacist symbol, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. Probably some Nazi group has used Pikachu.
Yeah.
Yeah. That is so funny. Yeah. It's, you know, it's remarkable. There's these moments that come up in media that are, it's so, there's this swirl of everything happening all the time. We're all on X in our jobs. We all have to follow the commentary. And it's sometimes difficult to know, like, am I crazy or is the rest of the world crazy?
Right.
And then there's some things that clarify for you that we're not the crazy ones.
And it's everyone
else. It's the rest of the people.
And so they're out to get me.
Yes. Yeah. They hate you. Just because you're paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get you. But I had one of these moments like a day or two ago. It was Holocaust Remembrance Day. And
setup for a joke.
You chuckled. I don't know why.
We were telling so many Holocaust jokes this week. No, proceed.
How many? No. So J.D. Vance puts out a post of him, I believe, at Auschwitz, the Holocaust Memorial. You know, this is commemorating the millions who died, and this is evidence of how humans can treat each other very brutally.
That won't help him with the Nick Fuentes crowd.
Well, it's so remarkable because I saw the post and I thought it was completely unremarkable. Like, I mean, you know, perfectly appropriate sentiment for Holocaust Remembrance Day and nothing else. And then later it starts to surface as this is literal Holocaust denial. This is the most insensitive, you know, white supremacist winking thing I've ever seen. And I'm like, what is the problem here? And so I had to like, and it was the other irritating factor of where like people are outraged, but they
not explaining why.
Yeah, they're foaming at the mouth, so they can't say explicitly what they think is wrong. Mm-hmm. Finally, I figured it out. It's that like it doesn't say 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust right in the tweet, right? And so therefore, by not saying those explicit words, J.D. Vance was winking to white nationalists, minimizing the Holocaust.
Yeah. Wait, if that's, as we always say, it's bad either way.
It's bad either
no
way.
No matter how many. It could be fewer. It could be... No, we're kidding.
No.
It was 6 million.
But it's just like... Yeah, where do you... Where do you... How do you... How does that become the source of your outrage, right? And it's similar. It happens on the... And I don't care for J.D. Vance at all, you know? I think he has kind of like played a little footsie with not denouncing white nationalists or whatever.
He could denounce more, sure. It could be denounced.
But it's this thing happens too. There's been a couple instances of where some Christians have died on Easter Sunday, mm-hmm. right? There was a terrorist attack in Sri Lanka a few years back. And then more recently, there was like a big bus crash in South Africa on Easter Sunday or whatever. And so like the media or people expressing their condolences refer to them as Easter worshipers. And then the right goes insane. Why? Because it's like, who worships Easter? Christians, say our name. Ugh. And it's like, unless
it was
you're
on
an
Easter.
Idiot, yeah, you
it was
know.
On Easter.
Yeah. What is the problem here? But it's just it's
when you think everyone is out to get you, the exact mindset I was manifesting and admitting that I very much have. it can be paranoia is a bad thing.
The constant discourse has a deranging effect. Paranoia, but this is proof that we are not subject to it. We are above the rest. So here we are.
Paranoia lends itself toward conspiratorial thinking.
Yeah.
And actually, this is related to a topic I very much wanted to get to today, Kanye West.
Mm, okay.
Did you see that? This week he put out an apology.
He denounced
in the Wall Street Journal
anti-Semitism.
And saying that it was because he's mentally ill.
Yeah.
And a lot of people reacted. And I see this reaction all the time. My co-host on Rising, she had this reaction too. She's like, okay, mental illness doesn't make you racist. Mental illness doesn't make you anti-Semitic. And the response to that is, that's incorrect.
Yeah.
It actually, mental illness often, frequently mm-hmm. manifests as racism, that's why when you encounter crazy people on the street, they're not muttering incomprehensible gobbledygook. They're muttering slurs.
Right.
They're muttering they borrow the they adapt the language of of these crazy ideas, of these hateful ideas,
yeah,
in the manifestation of their mental illness.
Right.
There are aliens. They're out to get me. They're implanting things in my brain. It's the Jews. It's Israel. Like, that's all very much mental illness.
Right.
It manifests itself in this exact way all the time.
Right.
Freddie DeBoer has been on this for a long time. He points this out every time he hears this reaction to someone like Kanye West. Like, oh, no, I've worked with mentally ill people. I myself have had mental illness that I've dealt with. They are like this. Like, go to a mental health facility, you will find people saying and doing exactly the kind of things Kanye West has been doing.
Right.
Which is not to say you have to forgive him or like accept that this is sincere, but the literal point you're making that, well, the mental illness couldn't do this to you is like factually false.
Right. Yeah, I guess it is just an interesting like effort to like not sympathize with people who are clearly unwell,
right.
Which is a little unfortunate. I guess, yeah, that's just like the one. You know, you can be mentally ill and do all sorts of damaging and say all sorts of terrible things, but like, oh, once you're schizophrenic and racist, yeah, then oh no, then you're a real bastard. Yeah, it is interesting how basically all conspiracy theories, because each like conspiracy theorists, like the nature of a conspiracy theory is that all the dots connect, and shadowy forces are controlling events, you know, beyond people's immediate perceptions,
right,
but you are able to connect disparate bits of information and produce this narrative of what's really going on. Basically, every single conspiracy theory eventually ropes in the Jews and anti-Semitism, right?
Mm-hmm.
Channel 5, or before that, All Gas, No Breaks was the name of the channel. Andrew Callahan.
Yeah.
So he does great interviews all the time.
Yeah.
And he used to do a lot more just kind of like, I'm going to go to this like wacky, crazy place of, you know, people being drunk at a NASCAR rally or whatever and interview drunk people. It's like, that was always fun. But he went to a Flat Earther convention. And, you know, Flat Earther is like, but before I knew anything about it, I was like, oh, this is kind of like ridiculous and silly,
harmless.
Yeah, but then he interviews him. He's like, "Oh no, all these people are also really anti-Semitic." It's because you believe the flat Earth, and so it becomes pretty easy to then believe that you know, some anti-Semitism as well. It's a similar thing with David. You know, David Icke. Maybe he's the guy who's like originated the lizard people conspiracy theories.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's also kind of an anti-Semitic element to that as well. Even though, like, David Icke, I mean, not a good guy, conspiracy theorist, but like his primary thing isn't being a rabid Jew hater, it's being a rabid crazy person, right? And where that your mind takes you, it's like it ropes in this thing that has been a long, you know, it ropes in every conspiracy theory, and because there's anti-Semitic conspiracy theories, it ropes them into. So.
Let's not alienate too much of the prospective audience here, though.
The
crazy people, they're right, and there are, you know, they said we were crazy for thinking COVID came from a lab.
And that turned out to be wrong.
That was wrong.
No. The lab was right.
The idea that you're crazy to believe it.
Yeah.
Well, that's why you can't. And I always warn people not to write off the crazies entirely. But then the mistake the other way is thinking, but that means then that what every crazy thing is true, which is, you know, is not the case.
And if you don't have expertise in this particular area, it can be difficult. So here's kind of my heuristic for stuff like this. I mean, lab leak is a great example.
Yeah.
Any sort of, you know, vaccine stuff, scientific controversy, whatever, is just because people have no memories and things become controversial really suddenly, right? Just go back in time, read some stuff, read the debate before it became this flashpoint political issue, right? And if there's sensible people on both sides, then the people who are crazy today are probably their ideas are not inherently crazy, right? That's how to do it. Like, lab leak, like, that was a mainstream concern before the COVID pandemic. The Tylenol might have a role in causing autism. You know, that's speculative, but, like, it wasn't a crazy belief prior to RFK coming out and saying it. Again, I'm not saying that's right. I don't know anything about that, but it's not inherently crazy because a lot of mainstream people, serious people, not necessarily mainstream, but just, like, serious people who have credentials and are studied in their area of expertise thought that, right? That's how you, I think, avoid both, you know, just immediately defaulting to whatever is allegedly the consensus mainstream once something becomes controversial, and also not immediately just believing whatever the conspiratorial or heterodox view is.
That's also, lest anyone think, just talking about conspiratorial thinking on like the fringe right, you know, it has moved from the left to, I think, almost the mainstream of democratic or liberal or progressive thinking to say, you know, the shadowy forces guiding everything are what are corporate interests in the most abstract, the corporate interest, this amorphous evil energy ball is guiding world events in a way to harm working people.
Yeah.
And sometimes that is given more flavor, and frankly, they are just talking about the Jews, and sometimes it's left to the billionaires, the wealthy, they're taking from you. How? Yeah. Don't think about that too closely. It all fits.
Right. Yeah, that's this is a mainstay of even when he was just like back on like Fox watching Tucker Carlson's monologues. It was this constant rhetoric of they, right? And sometimes he'd have explicit, shadowy forces he was naming. He's a little more explicit about that now. But
yeah.
It was normally just like, they want you to smoke weed and be indolent.
Right.
Who was they?
Yeah.
It's not exactly clear. The big marijuana companies? Right. They don't want you to smoke cigarettes because nicotine frees your mind or whatever he said, which is true, even though cigarettes are bad for you.
Yeah, but we love them.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. They said they almost let us smoke in here while we were doing this.
We decided that was going to be a fire hazard? We don't care about it. Let's unplug some fire safety systems.
Yeah, right. It would almost.
I don't know about you. I've unplugged all the fire alarm detectors in my apartment. If there's a fire, someone else will let me know. It's just when the battery starts to die and then it beeps in that annoying way once every 5 minutes in the middle of the night, that talking about driving you to insane and paranoid thinking. Like, I wish they would stop, you know, taking out the batteries of my smoke alarms.
Right, yeah.
They should stop doing that.
Yeah, it's just terrible how they've done that. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Over the Christmas break, I was staying with my my parents, and the morning after Christmas, I indulged a little on Christmas Day, and so I was a little tipsy, and at like 4 in the morning, you hear the beep of the
Santa?
Not Santa. He didn't come back. It was this smoke alarm, but it was literally the most inconvenient possible place. My parents, like, their dining room has like a
under the mistletoe, like, and you had to kiss somebody.
Yeah, if only now. No, it's like an 18-foot ceiling or something like that. So it's like, in order to get it, I had to stand on a chair and use a broom.
Maybe a candy cane pole with a little.
Yeah, I'm glad you think this is funny, but a hungover Christian at 4 in the morning trying to stop this ear-splitting racket without blaming any group in particular did not find it so amusing. So,
well, they have gotten to my washer and dryer.
Oh, yeah.
The ones I'm, because I live in a large apartment building that you don't pick, you know, it comes with the unit.
Yep.
And I love everything about my apartment and my building except the washer dryer because they're Obama era or Biden.
Oh, these Biden boxes.
The efficiency ones
that
don't fucking dry the clothes no matter how many times you set it. It tosses the clothes for 4 hours. They're still damp. You can't. I was, again, my better half tried to wash like the bath mats. Like, those things are too heavy.
Yeah.
You put, as soon as they get wet, it's over. I'm like, we're just gonna have to throw them away. They're never gonna dry. They did finally dry. But I was gonna take a baseball bat to this machine. I can't do it. That's his job. I can't do it. It frustrates me too much. And it's because they being Democratic Obama administrators imposed new energy efficient standards that that I would. Truly, even, I'm a libertarian voter. I always vote for the Libertarian Party. I would vote for Republicans over Democrats on the basis of that issue itself.
This is why we get Trump, is because the libs, they can't
help themselves. Trump over the
they can't help themselves.
Washer not working.
So I actually know a bit about this because I've done. I used to write a fair bit about
compared
it
compared to me.
No, of course not. You write real
things and contemplate actual issues. I talk on TV.
No, I'm sorry. To use my favorite conversational tick to not sound condescending. I'm probably telling you stuff you already know. But,
go ahead.
But so Obama came in and imposed a bunch of ridiculous energy efficiency standards.
Let me be clear. No one is saying you were going to take away – if you like your washing machine, you can keep your washing machine. Liar.
Lies. Complete lies. Let me be clear about there my are those illegal who say
we're taking a washing machine that you liked.
What we are doing is giving people choices. Yeah.
Yes.
No. So the Obama administration comes in, issues a bunch of regulatory orders.
Commie bullshit.
Yep. Ramping up the energy efficiency standards on dishwashers, on washing machines, light bulbs, what have you. So all these products don't work as well anymore, right? Because a good dishwasher uses a shitload of water and electricity, less than hand washing it, which is what people switch to after the energy efficiency standards, and then produces a nice clean dish, right? The shower heads, same thing. A nice, relaxing, beautifully cleansing shower.
If you have these devices from the 90s, hold on to these things for dear God.
Take them out of my beautifully washed and well-pressured hands. No. And so, but then Trump ran on this, right? He ran on it in 2016. He's like, I can't take a shower anymore because of these ridiculous rules. And he was right. And then they eventually, I mean, his administration dragged its feet for forever, but eventually they got rid of him right at the end. And then Biden gets back in, with his plan to save democracy. Mm. His one political objective was to put Donald Trump's political legacy in the ground to end this and move on as a country. We're all doing this to save the soul of democracy. We can all unite to say that that was too crazy and a little scarily authoritarian. Let's move on as a nation. And then they go right back to doing all the shit that annoys people, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. This is, I don't vote. I can't vote for Republicans, but this is why I could never vote for Democrats either,
sure.
even with all their even though I buy some of the Trump is uniquely dangerous or whatever, is because all they use that
argument
for...
I'm uniquely dangerous after if I have to dry my clothes a fourth fucking time. That's what I'll say to that.
And people hate it. The voters hate it. So it's like your political... The thing that you're promising me you can do, which is like stop like populism, Trumpy populism destroying our politics, you can't do because all you do when you say I'm here to save democracy is just use that as license for all the other bullshit you wanted to do, right? They're not giving up the power or this desire to like just mess with these things that really bother people. They're just using it as license to continue doing the things that they want.
The only thing I can hope is that is maybe maybe you're going to laugh at me if I say this. Is Josh Shapiro different? Like, I saw him this week complaining about Biden and the, for instance, the broadband connection type stuff, the infrastructure money that Democrats all voted for to, and, I would not have supported this in the first place, but if you decide to do it, then do it.
Yeah.
And him being like, we didn't connect a single person. They didn't build, they spent a lot of money to build, charging stations for electric cars. They didn't build any. They can't do anything because they have too many bureaucrats and labor restrictions and environmental issues that they can't. This is why people are moving to red states because they can actually build housing.
Yeah.
And California appropriated the money to build a high-speed rail line, before you were born?
Yeah.
And they can't. They can't do it.
I think it's one of the first referendum.
Yeah, whatever. Sometime like that.
Okay, I'm sure.
Well, you're 15.
was I? Yeah. I don't know. You'd hope that there would be some lessons learned, right?
Yeah.
I think Biden was just way too old and also kind of like a falsely portrayed himself as a moderate when he came in 2020 to like kind of stop, because all the irritating regulatory stuff they did was basically just Trump repealed this Obama rule. We're going to bring the Obama rule back and then come up with a new one that's probably going to be more restrictive, right? And I don't know how much of that was just like, this is just what the Democrats do, or Biden was senile and not really interested in the details.
He was asleep at the wheel. I think they staffed the administration with
just like
Young progressive. You have to go. I think
young progressives or Biden Obama holdovers. Right. And so, of course, that's what they do.
If you're going to govern like a Josh Shapiro as a Democrat or like the Colorado governor we all like.
Jared Polis.
Right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. If you're going to be a Jared Polis, which is great. And that I would, I could get on board with that. You have to go out of your way to hire unusual, atypical, Derek Thompson style Democrats or something.
Yeah.
Because your default Democrat is someone who wants to bring the who's not your default Democratic voter, but your default Democratic staffer, your default person who wants to work for a Democratic administration's energy department is someone you know, who wants to bring the gears of capitalism to a screeching halt.
Right. Yeah. I do wonder if you had a – I mean, Jared Polis. I love Jared Polis. He's always willing to talk to reason, which is great.
Yeah.
But or a Josh Shapiro, who I'm, you know, less of a fan of, but seems better than what, you know, many of the alternatives. I do wonder if they got in there, like, A, how much interest would they show in, like, stopping these sources of these seemingly minor but very real sources of, you know, rage at the government? And then B, just, like, how much ability would they actually have, right? Because, like, what are they going to do, appoint a bunch of people from the Competitive Enterprise Institute to, like, write their appliance policies? Are they just, like, you're a president, you have only so much bandwidth, and so you have to pull, you know, you kind of have to go to war with the army you have, and that's always going to include a lot of these little regulators pulling their, you know, pulling their little strings.
Well, and that's why libertarian-leaning policy professional-type people just end up being more naturally at home working with Republicans because while we may not like so much of what Trump represents personally or even what he's doing in terms of policy on trade and other things, you know, if you're an education policy person in libertarian world, you want to do school choice, that's they're going to do that if there's a Republican, and there's like a 2 in 100 chance they'll do that if it's a Democrat.
Right.
You know, if you're a CEI type person who wants to repeal some regulation, again, Republican probably on board unless it's one of Trump's personal, like, no, we should own Intel sort of idiosyncrasies, then you're screwed. But otherwise, you just got to. I mean, that's not true for everything. If you're, well, I don't know, if you're a drug policy person, who would you rather have?
It's actually kind of a, it's a mix, it's a real mixed bag.
Certainly, if you're an immigration person, if you're, I'm not saying that, like, Republicans are better on all issues, but it tends to be the case. I don't think that at all. I think both parties are bad on, like, all issues. But it's, for whatever reason, we've found less to work with Democrats. Again, not true down the
board. Is immigration the one thing where Democrats are, like, head and shoulders, just, like, the more have the more libertarian position? Because, like, everything else that I can think of that's allegedly, like, foreign policy.
Well, that's only true of this iteration of the Republican Party, too.
Yeah, right.
If
you
go back to 2005,
that's a good point.
That's not, it's not clear.
True. Right, this is a rare moment where the parties are pretty darn polarized on immigration.
Also, and then on foreign policy, who can tell anymore? Who knows what the parties stand for in foreign policy?
Right, right.
Who knows what Trump stands, you know, it's...
But that's my point. There's not a clear, like, if you're libertarian on this issue and this issue alone, you should vote for these guys.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have a friend, you know, who does a lot of, like, reform at, like, state level stuff. And what he says, you know, in, like, some sort of deregulatory thrust, and he's like, when, like, Republicans can be bad on an issue, you know, it's like housing, we're particularly in housing, and so it's like Republicans can be easily bad on housing, right? The ideological map is all over the place when it comes to housing and zoning reform, but when they're good, they're good. They're like, okay, yep, deregulation, I understand the language, let's do it. Democrats are also all over the map. Some of them are really bad, some of them can be good, but when they're good, it's like, ooh, okay, yes, how do we manage the coalition here so that we get labor to support, you know, a little bit of deregulation in exchange for this mandate, and, you know, how do we work with the environment? It's just like, it's like it's the person you invite to the party and ask if 5 other friends can come, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The Republican is like, I'll be there with a 30 rack if you want them there, right? Yeah. And then the Democrat's like, ooh, well, how about, do you mind?
Yeah, yeah, we're like, are they girls?
All right, because, then don't bring them.
Well, if I'm having a board game night and we're playing a board game that only 5 people can play,
right?
You know, then more is not the merrier. If we're playing like Secret Hitler, then more the merrier up to a point,
right? Exactly.
Speaking of,
I tell you what, I made 2 homophobic cracks so far, so you can do a Bane impersonation if you want.
I'll keep that in my back pocket for a choice moment later in the just. Stay tuned.
Oh, that
would have
been a perfect time for a Do You Feel?
I merely adopted the darkness. You were born into it, molded by it.
All right. Okay, put it back in the back pocket.
I was going to talk finally about the only thing I want to talk about today, which is the weather.
Oh, boy.
And the way local, speaking of a black pilling, red pilling, no, black pilling is when you just embrace depression.
When you're hopeless,
Okay. Well, I'm not hopeless. Is there a pill to embrace liberty, market anarchy? We need a pill color for that. Which one's not claimed?
Yellow is traditionally the color of classical liberalism.
Is it?
Yellow and black would be ANCAP colors, but I guess saying I'm yellow and black pilled would be kind of confusing.
Our little bumblebee pill.
Yeah, right.
Zing, zing.
Okay, let's try and coin it right now. Say you're yellow pilled. You know?
Okay, I'm yellow pilled. Mm-hmm. I'm a little sunflower.
Yeah,
yellow pilled.
Yeah.
Because the government did such a bad job at plowing the roads.
Yeah.
The most, one of the most fundamental jobs of government, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
You have to be pretty far down anarchy to say that, which I'm now in favor of.
Yeah, that the roads should be privatized.
The roads
yeah.
must mm-hmm. be privately owned so yes. that someone will plow them.
Yes.
Because the government has demonstrated they won't do it. This snowstorm that we had, that I had to cancel plans for, that I've rescheduled to this weekend, so
terrible.
Better not snow again. I saw that on a little forecast, and they're saying it's not going to happen probably. Better stay that way.
Yeah.
Don't abuse this wishing stone anymore. They
should have given it to me.
they knew this storm was coming, and I initially thought they did a pretty good job because mm-hmm. the major roads were cleared the next morning. I actually got to work in less time than it usually takes
because
no one was driving.
It's like, yeah, that was great. Keep doing that.
I was good. Then I didn't know they were done.
Yeah.
I didn't know they were not going to plow any further. So by about yesterday afternoon, it dawned on everyone in D.C. at the same time that
they're not doing anything.
Oh, this is it.
Yeah.
Schools mm-hmm. are going to stay closed until it melts.
Right.
Like, they're just not. There was no plan mm-hmm. to get back to anything. And everyone in the district revolted against that at the same – like it all dawned on us yesterday at 2 p.m. And then we all started tweeting about it like crazy and Muriel Bowser panicked and then
had like a big like FEMA press conference.
Did deploy additional plows. They have been out. The roads are improved somewhat from yesterday. They did have school today. People are back out on the roads. It was actually a huge, huge pain to get here to reason because there were so many more cars out there and people and I'm driving like a maniac trying to get here. I lay on the horn constantly anyway. I'm swerving ahead of people. I'm hurling epithets at whoever I pass regardless, like, oh, it's another, you know, white guy in his 65. Like I would say this about literally anyone.
Was there a white guy who was 65?
Well, you know,
sorry.
No one's driving well, actually, right now, except for me.
Yeah.
You
were the one person. I don't drive.
You were also late.
Yes, I was.
You had a little bit of trouble.
Yes, I did. So this is a private issue. I can't necessarily blame the government on it. But
you can blame them.
I can blame them.
Did they do this to you?
Very good. I guess so, yeah. So I live in
relative squalor.
Relative squalor, yeah. This is the
Have you come up in the world? Because you started from real squalor. I've seen some of your past living accommodations.
No, I don't live in a disgusting...
And have recoiled in horror.
Yeah. that was not my fault. But I used to live in a disgusting slum house that Robbie has been to where, you know... the less said about what happened there, the better.
Yeah.
No, so I live in, I make a trade-off that many people make in the city, which is that I want to be close to work and
close to the action.
Close to the action. I want to be able to walk everywhere.
You want to be able to stumble home drunkenly with minimum risk of you know, getting mugged or
passing
out and dying.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. What does this trade-off mean? It means that you live in a bad unit in a nice neighborhood, which is where I live. And so the doors in my place have, like, they always have these problems. They got these, like, gaps underneath them.
Doors.
Bugs get in, warm air gets out, which is a real problem when it's fucking 8 degrees here, mm-hmm. right? The ice most recently caused my door to splinter at the bottom. And when I tried to open it, a giant chunk fell off. And so now I have a giant hole at the bottom of my door.
It's not good.
So my already drafty apartment is completely frozen now. The landlord said he sent a guy over today, and so hopefully they will fix it. So that's good private response.
There you go.
I was actually quite impressed with, given the state of the roads, that he was able to come out and say we might be able to get this done today. So we shall see. If he does not come through, though, then I will be an irate customer next week. I don't drive, but it's even quite difficult to walk because a lot of the sidewalks haven't been treated or anything like that. And then also because of the government's plowing efforts, these giant piles of snow are just sitting unmoved.
And they're frozen solid. It's chunks of ice.
Yeah, just right at the every intersection. So yeah. You have to clamber over those to get across every intersection. Yeah, for people who, you know, I mean, I know like a lot of the Eastern Seaboard got this kind of weather, right. But for
people like, oh, this is so interesting, your unique challenges, but.
You know what? The government has failed us here. Yeah, you know what? Yeah.
Well, I'm from Michigan, so I'm used to snow. We get snowstorms, and then what happens is 8 hours after it stops snowing, they have plowed everything, and everything is fine.
So the government can do this. It's not impossible.
It does this in other places. This isn't even an indictment of government. It is an indictment of the government you and I have here.
DC's government, yeah.
Like, Virginia has done a better job, according to Natalie and people who live in Virginia for some reason.
Yeah.
It's a DC problem.
I praised Muriel Bowser when she announced that she wasn't running for a third term for mayor on this very show because I was like, she doesn't really care about governing the city and therefore doesn't go all in on like this lefty progressive do-gooder nonsense. And that was kind of her primary benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously the failure of that is she doesn't care about running the city.
Yeah, this
and so
has not been her best moment.
No, not so good. Not so good. Yeah. People are outraged. People are outraged. It has given me time to spent more time inside watching Mad Men. You'll have to be happy.
Oh, yes. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, we're midway through season two.
Yeah, oh, same. I am too.
Something that just happened that I wanted to talk about. What the fuck was it? We just finished the episode where they're the pitch to American Airlines fails that put in all that work for, and then the guy, their contact
gets
at
fired,
Airlines
and
gets
so it's
fired,
a dumb deal,
so it's,
right,
not going to go through.
Really useless, yeah.
God, it's so good. I was reflecting. Oh, that episode is also shows some of the Catholic stuff.
Right, Peggy.
Peggy's origin.
She has there's a priest character that's introduced.
Right, who finds her interesting because she is interesting, and that inspires jealousy of her very pious sister, who then rats out. You know, Peggy.
In the confessional, Peggy had a child out of wedlock, and her sister rats out.
Yeah. Using the confession booth in that completely self-serving way. I thought that was very good.
I mean, yes and no. I actually really sympathized with her sister in that respect because it's like, hey, I mean, that is, you know, if you're having.
It's prodigal son. It was the prodigal son story. Being, I mean, you've already had your reward. You have your reward awaiting you.
It is so. I mean, it is like. Frame for frame, the prodigal son, right? Where one child goes off and, you know, blows his fortune and then comes back and his father embraces him. And the dutiful son, that's how the story ends, is the dutiful son is
welcomed back.
Yeah, he's welcomed back. And then the dutiful son is angry because it's like, I've done everything right. It didn't blow my inheritance. And all of a sudden you're being honored now. I mean, I think there's a reason it's in the Bible, right?
It's part of the fundamental
human experience, right?
Yes.
And so I think it was right that she like brought it in the confessional, even though obviously she had an ulterior motive too. She wanted to slander her sister in front of a priest who was showing Peggy attention instead of her. So she had an ulterior motive, but I think it was a human motive. I think the priest gave her good advice too, and that in the confessional too was just like, you know, you'll have your reward later. Get over it, right? Yeah.
Basically the moral of the tale.
Yeah, I've been watching season two as well. And so I always get a little nervous when you have like priest characters or clergy on shows because inevitably they're some massive hypocrite or psychotic abuser or
child rapist.
But or at least the butt of the joke or whatever. Mm-hmm. And the Mad Men portrayal of the priest, I think maybe some, you know, like viewers who aren't like particularly Catholic might find him annoying or preachy. I mean, that is his job. But I thought it was actually like pretty sympathetic, and he's, I think, trying to do what a good thing with
Peggy.
I
find it very, very real. You know, I too went through had a Catholic upbringing and you're a convert, right?
Revert. So raised Catholic, stopped practicing back in church. But.
So I had that education and so we knew priests and that reminded me very of a strong positive portrayal of one.
Totally, absolutely. Every family that they want the priest to come over for dinner.
I was explaining that to my better half. He was like, what is that? I'm like, that's how it is.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a huge honor to have the priest.
Absolutely.
The way they behave is so true.
Yeah.
It was like it was written or consulted on by a Catholic or something.
Yes. He did. I was reading an interview with, what's his name, Matthew Weiner, right?
Yeah.
He did talk to some priests. for the show. Yeah, I love the bit. My mother wasn't quite like this, but like, there's a big thing with my dad. Definitely was like, there's a big thing with Catholics where it's like, there's no ad-libbing when it comes to saying grace, right? You know,
yes.
The prayer you say before.
Oh, that was a great joke. The prayer that you was say, lovely, Father. Now you're going to say grace.
Right, yeah, yeah. The priest, he's there for dinner, and he says, you know, she's like, do you want to say grace? And Catholics have a very specific prayer that you say before you eat your food.
Yep.
And he goes off on, says some New Age stuff about, you know, togetherness.
Right, because he's kind of a liberal, younger, newer.
Yeah, he's a yeah, he's Jesuit. He's a new guy. He's trying to bring a you know a fresh spin to
Vatican II.
Mm-hmm. This is pre-Vatican II.
It's coming along,
right? Yeah, yeah. But you can kind of see that
the seeds
urge,
of it,
right? Yeah, and then the mother is like, okay, but seriously, are you going to say grace, right? I really love that aspect. Yeah, so that's the other thing I actually liked about it was that like he is shown as like a younger guy who has, you know, he wants to, you know, reinvigorate the church and reach the youth. But he's also not like he's a sympathetic guy without being like he's not going to war with the church either. Being
right.
Like, you're right, Peggy. Right. We gotta change this place around
right.
here. Right. So I kind of like that. I thought that was actually a really well done character. So
I like that, too. I love what I love about Mad Men. Again, watching it again, this is even, you know, clear if you already you kind of remember it and you kind of know where the episode is going. I love when an episode of prestige television has like a theme, like a light background theme.
Mm-hmm.
And often in Mad Men, the campaign they're working on or the pitch has to do with the theme and like fits what the episode is about. And I love Mad Men is so good at that. Like this episode we're talking about, the American Airlines one, like you know, they had to let go they had an airline that they should have stuck with, and they let them go to chase this airline. And Roger is feeling marital frustration.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He's looking for younger girls, and he says he's excited about the chase, and he's paying for a prostitute. And Don is like, why are we doing this? We had an air – not that Don is a perfect upstanding moral bastion or
no,
anything. But,
not at all. Not
but
at
Don
all.
Is like, we had an airline we're doing good creative work for. Why are we chasing this? And
right.
Roger's like, but the chase is just fun. And like, but he's like going through a midlife crisis.
Right. But I mean, Don is also, I mean, that's his constant problem. He has a wife and children at home and a beautiful
who he
wife.
Treats
and,
horribly.
Abysmally. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's watching this the second time, there's a lot more that I'm really enjoying Mad Men, although I can already feel the fatigue of, I feel like, later in the seasons where it's just like, there's just not like enough life or death stakes to like really keep me engaged after a certain
point.
Yeah,
you talked about that. You need the life and death stakes.
Yes, but to put that aside, do not repeat myself. I am really enjoying watching it the second time because I'm seeing just like how much more of a rich show it is. Just visually, right? Like there's a scene from the first season where Roger, he's, you know, sleeping with the secretary Joan. And he brings her as a present, a bird in a cage, right?
Yeah.
And she like, you know, there's a perfect shot of like the cameras behind the cage, and she looks into it through the cage, and it's like,
yes,
she's also the cage bird. There's just that like,
that's,
I mean, this is this is a very like similar, like, or very like basic film analysis, but there is just that like that rich language. You're telling a story both in what the characters do and then also in just like the images you show. Yeah, there's another thing I really noticed that I like about Mad Men is like they'll get some product or prop or new person in the office, right? And then just like all the different characters, their storyline revolves around that, right? Like in the one episode where the Duck Phillips, he brings his dog in.
Yes.
Right? He brings the dog in and then like he's there talking to someone, then someone, you know, they mention the dog, you know, introduces some new character, and then someone else comes up to talk to the dog, and it's like, this is bringing in another storyline, then we're going to follow that character. Like, the dog kind of just becomes the center of the universe of the episode. Yeah, it's so good in that way. I really like it.
I like how all the characters, the kind of secondary tier of characters, right? You have Don, Roger, Pete, Betty, Joan, Peggy as like your main six, and then there's so many other characters. But you know, the group of like up and coming guys, the second tier Pete Campbell people, Paul Kinsey, Ken Cosgrove, Harry Crane, those people who are all like finding their place at the firm, and like some of that, you know, Harry Crane makes himself the head of the TV department, and then we all know that TV takes off, and he becomes actually very important and very vital, despite not being particularly well-liked or shown to be this brilliant person, but he got on board the right thing. And then you have Paul, who fashions himself as this very creative person and wants to be like Don.
Sure.
And he kind of never – he doesn't, like, fail spectacularly, but he doesn't – rise in any way.
Well, and then he kind of completely burns out.
Well,
right?
He completely burns out eventually. But it's just, it's clever how it's very relatable. Like, you know, if you work in an office and opportunities are presented to people, some people really blow your expectations off the roof. Some people just kind of keep doing the same thing they're doing. Some people fall off and are not good.
You hit your wagon to the right horse, right? Yeah, yeah, sure.
Sometimes it's kind of just luck. Like for Harry, it was just luck.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, sure. Yeah, because he's not shown to be... I mean, he has some initiative, right? But he's not shown to be, like, particularly intelligent or...
No, he gets kind of lucky.
Yeah, he gets kind
of
lucky.
He has to be put in charge of the right thing at the right time before the thing is too big that they'd put somebody better in charge of it.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
That's life.
Yeah.
Yeah, something that... There's a thing that's very easy to do, and it's inevitable that you're going to do it when you watch a TV show like this for the first time, where it's like, it's all about, you know, you have your main character who is flawed, but like they're the one you're rooting for, right? So like in your own mind, you constantly downplay their flaws because you're just like, oh, how are they going to get out of this situation that their own horrible actions have gotten into? Mm-hmm. And that was kind of my attitude watching Mad Men the first time. But I'm watching it the second time, I'm just realizing just like what a POS he is to Betty. She accuses him of infidelity
bad to Betty.
Correctly.
Yeah.
And he just like directly in her eyes, like, no, that's not true. Right. And it's like, the first time I watched it, I'm like, okay, is he going to get out of this? Is he going to get out of this? You know, is old Donnie going to dance his way out of this? And then the second time I'm watching it, I'm like, wow, you fucking monster. But
it's complicated. I love Betty as a character.
Yeah.
But I don't particularly sympathize with her for some reason.
She's very grating and annoying.
But that's not to say the character annoys me. I like the character a lot. Mm-hmm. I enjoy the I like everything about the character. I like watching her. But I don't feel like I'm in her.
She's a very cold person.
She's cold
to start with.
Cause she's a wasp. She's,
yes.
It's a little bit what her character is, that she was raised to be this kind of
patrician,
austere, and you feel sorry for her that she's not, you know, Peggy is a career woman and is evolving outside of traditional roles reserved for women. Joan actually does too, vis-a-vis a very different pathway, but she also comes into a position of authority, and Betty doesn't and is clearly unfulfilled.
Yeah.
But also that was clearly her choice.
Yeah.
And you know what I mean?
Yeah, sure. Totally.
Which makes it gray and complicated in a way that's appealing.
She has the frustrations of someone who feels like they did everything right and has nevertheless been left behind, which is a lot of, I mean, that's the Peggy's sister. That's, some of the people at the ad agency, right?
I mean, that's everyone. you do everything right, and yet you still feel lingering unhappiness some of the time. And it's about, and Don's theory of creative and advertising is that the purpose of it is to mitigate that feeling that we all have for as long as possible and translate that into selling you something, which is Randian.
Okay. There we go. That's not so bad.
That it is a good, it is a moral good to mitigate that feeling in exchange for money.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So I'll put, I got to say, one other thing I wanted to bring up is, I watched, except I've been just kind of like watching it in binges, particularly because the weather's been so bad.
Yeah.
There's that line, I think my favorite line of the series, I'll never get over this, is when Don, he's like smoking weed with the beatniks and they're just being assholes about how much he hates.
Great line.
How much he, you know, is like, oh, advertising's bad or whatever. Yeah. And eventually he's like, fuck this, I'm going to get out of here. And the cops are in the hallway of the apartment, like arresting the neighbor next door. And as he's about to leave, what's he say? One of the beatniks is like, hey, you can't go out there. And Don is just like, you can't. And then leaves, right?
He's a man in a suit.
Because for whatever his own internal conflicts, like he has claimed for himself a degree of freedom in the world through his success, which in a way, also a little Randian, right? Yeah.
In a show that is morally complicated and is saying a lot of different things, that doesn't have a clear agenda, another example of the lefty hippie people coming off the worst.
Yeah,
almost like a one-dimensional character. Very
absolutely.
Very much like Eddington or a couple other things we've talked about where it's like, you know, no one, again, a conservative would not recognize this as a right-wing thing. And it's not a right-wing thing. It does not clearly advance that, but it is certainly not a left-wing thing because its left-wing characters are loathsome.
Conservatives and libertarians have to work a little harder to find our media that actually speaks to our values, but it's out there. If you're an Ubermensch, you can divine these things. Wait, so let me ask you before we move on to another topic. Can I ask you, of all the canonical like golden age of TV prestige dramas, and so like in my mind immediately I'm thinking The Wire, Breaking Bad, Mad Men, Sopranos, and maybe there's a few others you'd add on there. Like, which of those is your favorite? Which do you think
tough.
Is the best?
So I've never seen The Wire. Okay. My blind spot is The Wire. Mm-hmm. The other three, I consider Sopranos, Mad Men, Breaking Bad to be the height of television. I don't know which is my favorite. So I watched Sopranos, ironically, more recently than the other two for the first time. Mm-hmm. And maybe the answer is Sopranos. I go back and forth between the three. Mm-hmm. Breaking Bad does have the life and death. Well, Breaking Bad and Sopranos have the life and death stakes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Breaking Bad is so good from an we were talking about the visuals. That's the one I first noticed. And I'm no expert in cinematography or anything of that nature. I'm a story guy. We're writers. I like good plot.
Yeah.
But Breaking Bad was the first thing I watched that was so good that even I, someone who has no detail for like the graphics or whatever, just want the story to be good, noticed that, wow, how this is shot is so perfect.
Beautiful and interesting. And makes you relevant feel to the story,
relevant
right?
to the story. Well, the whole setting.
Every detail is so important.
The whole setting is relevant to the story because the setting is the desert, and the desert is harsh, and the desert is sparse. Mm-hmm. And so in Breaking Bad, there are no superfluous scenes. Mm. There are no superfluous lines of dialogue. There are no superfluous characters. Right. They don't introduce anything that is not going to be resolved. Every single line, every single word is functional because there's nothing extra in the desert. Mm. So the setting fits the way the story is told.
Yeah.
And it's so good.
I
don't know which of the three I like the best.
This is why I think it's... Maybe I don't like it the best, but this is why I think it's the best of all the shows. And weirdly, I feel like its reputation has fallen over time.
It may be the best of the three.
Yeah, because I watch Sopranos, like, I'll just, like, routinely, I'll throw on an episode, right?
Yeah.
And Mad Men has this aspect, too, where it's like, you know, there is, you know, it's a collection. A lot of the episodes are collections of short stories, right?
And Sopranos then, and Mad Men are more like that than Breaking Bad. Breaking Bad is not a collection of stories.
No, not at all. And then
Breaking Bad is a Shakespearean drama.
Yes. And of a man's moral descent, right? Into pure evil. But I think that's why it makes it the best show, like over the course of all the seasons, is because, you know, Don Draper, Tony Soprano are very good, real, interesting characters, as are many of the other characters in the show. But ultimately, they're kind of static characters in a way, right? They're not, you know, they're searching for meaning in a world that isn't providing.
They don't
it to
change
them.
A lot.
They don't change a lot. And they're kind of listless. They have what they think they want. Oh, they want something else. And at a certain point, I become a little bored of their constant kind of like moral existentialist struggle.
Sure.
Whereas Walter White is
He's just on an unstoppable
freight train going straight to evil.
Yes.
And it's just, it creates this momentum in the series that you need to see it, and then you need to see where it goes, and then it ends and it's done, and it's like it's such a neat, efficient story that I love that.
I agree with that. I mean, The Sopranos resonates with me personally more than the other two.
Breaking Bad
doesn't resonate with me personally at all. But The Sopranos, you know, I see, not that my family was involved in mob violence or anything, but I also had a very Italian Catholic upbringing. And so them having dinners on Sunday, like the salad bowl resonates with me.
Yeah.
Like the way it looks, the way they talk to each other, the way they interact, like the big, you know, I was arguing with someone about, you know, whether it's appropriate to hug or handshake someone. Mm. And I'm like, in my family, you hugged everybody. You kissed them twice. You felt them up. Like that's, you know, you're feeling for a wire. You gotta, greeting. That's how we all did it.
Right.
You know, the pinching of the cheeks. So that kind of thing is so familiar. And until I watched Sopranos, even though I watched it later in life, I did not understand that my own upbringing was so idiosyncratic to Italian Catholic. I just thought it was kind of the normal American experience, because I didn't have a lot with like the WASP, the archetype that Betty and Don has been brought into her family, really. it's just a totally different and alien thing to me because I had this thing.
Yeah.
But I didn't recognize that as distinct as much until I saw it on TV and I'm like, oh no, that's my thing. That's so different.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, sure, totally. Yeah, it's funny. It's like that's just like a huge plus for any media when it's like, this is about an environment I'm from and it kind of nails it. I guess none of the prestige dramas really do that for me. I guess Breaking Bad probably comes the closest, like aesthetically. Like I used to live in Idaho, so like not New Mexico, but like high desert, hanging out with a bunch of people smoking weed and cigarettes and dressed like Jesse Pinkman. Like I there's a little bit of
you're dressed a little bit like Jesse Pinkman today.
Right, the beanie, right? And although he wasn't really a rock fan, so I don't think he'd be wearing a Clutch shirt. But alas.
All right, what else should we talk about today?
Was there any other political topics we needed to hit?
Yeah, no, we just did a big TV. I had my washing machine. We did that. You know what? Let's actually talk about a little insider baseball thing we were doing before we started about formative stories for us in our careers.
Okay,
That'd be interesting to some people. Because we were talking about, you were bashing all your colleagues, you were throwing reason under the bus, you were saying how frustrated and discontented you are about some of our...
This is my last podcast ever,
Some of our editing processes, which have, I've been here, how long have you been at Reason now?
It'll be 9 years in April as a full-time staffer, and before that I was an intern, as were you, right?
I was an intern, yeah, not counting that, it's been, I guess I'm coming up on 12-ish years, something like that. And, we became, like so many other organizations, we had a very well put together print product, and then a little thing called the internet came along, and I was like, well, what's that for? Well, maybe that's just for quick takes. That's less polished, less edited. So we had a blog,
right?
Like so many other things,
hit and run,
right? And then at the time I joined Reason, the blog was a big deal, but it was still a blog. So you just wrote for it. And unlike the magazine, is carefully edited and pieces are commissioned and it's very deliberate.
Nope.
The blog was not like that. The blog was, we were not unique in that way. That's what a blog used to be like. I remember there's frequent examples of like me and Nick Gillespie like writing similar things or just on the same topic and posting back to back without, because we were just doing it independently.
Yeah.
This was before Slack. This was before widespread coordination.
It's before,
I didn't know what he was doing.
Right. It's before social media, too. And so, like, you go back and look at, like, because they're all still on the website, a lot of the old hit-and-run, blogs.
There's no
like,
SEO considerations.
There's no SEO consideration, which led for a lot more funny headlines. But also...
Just
like,
another isolated incident as the headline about... A police shooting.
When in the Facebook era, it would be like a 2-sentence long description of the actual event with as many keywords as possible. And you really were crossing your fingers that they shot a sexy teen mom.
Oh, yeah.
That's the dirty business
out of that one. Yeah. That's
but
how
it's
the
not,
sausage is made.
Yeah.
Or how it was made from 2010 to 2019.
Right. Right, yeah, so that was an interesting – so I came in right at the tail end of the most chaotic blog space. This was when I came in – I don't remember when Facebook started to really generate traffic for news articles.
Yeah, it was this time.
Okay, so I started as an intern in 2016, and then I became a full-time staffer in 2017, and that was when we first implemented
–
Yeah, that was peak Facebook traffic, right? Where it's like if you got something up at the right time on the right and got the right headline, it would get 5 million
By 2014, I had noticed that, wow, this is a pretty dominating traffic production. Mm-hmm. And by traffic, we mean referring back to the actual
article
site.
People clicking
people
on your website.
To Reason.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then, not that this matters as much to us because we're a donor-supported nonprofit, but... For-profit publications, that was a major source of their revenue because they were – the ads on the website were sold for more money because traffic was going to the website from Facebook.
Right. Mm-hmm.
From Facebook in a huge way and then cresting at 2017, 2018.
Right. And so, yeah, I guess it was a confluence of like, okay, so the name of the game when I first came on was you get an article – up at the right time with the right headline, but it can't just be a couple sentences in a block quote anymore. Like it's got to be like an actual article.
Right.
So then that brought in like a little bit more professionalism of the copy production
which
process.
Which was a good thing. People, someone in charge would actually read what you were writing, would make sure somebody else wasn't writing it too, would read what you're writing and would think through some of those things. But like my initial you know, the thing that first bumped me up a level in terms of national media profile and attention, most people know, was my debunking, so-called, of the University of Virginia gang sexual assault story in Rolling Stone magazine, where I was certainly not the first person to have doubts about it, but I was the first person to assemble those doubts into a blog post and post it for a major magazine. And, you know, with a very, like, incendiary headline that was like, is this a rape hoax or something?
Yeah.
That no one reviewed and no one signed off on, because at that era we just posted things that will
turned out to be correct, right?
And maybe I'm lucky, but it yes, within a day, the whole and I, you know, I got bashed for 24 hours. I was still new to Reason at the time. I'm like, could this be the end of me? Did I do something really wrong? But then so swift that it did fall apart, and it you know, came out that that the victim in this story, who had been the source for the story. You know, she had named her attacker. She knew who her attacker was, mm-hmm. but had not told that to the journalist. And then it just became clear that the journalist, Sabrina Rubin Erdley, had not sought comment from the so-called attacker and had not interviewed her friends and had not talked to any of the people who would have witnessed these events at the time.
So she botched it. The journalist botched it.
The journalist botched it so bad, because then all those people said, she's crazy. Mm-hmm. She made this up. Mm-hmm. She's crazy.
Yum.
So then it blew up. So I got really lucky.
Off to the races there. What year was that?
It was 2014.
Okay.
2014. Nice. And your story of origin that was your big first brush with fame was the Straws.
Yeah, the Straws. Yeah, so this was, if people remember the straw banning mania, which afflicted the nation for a while.
Yes.
It was a California legislator introduced a bill that was wasn't a straw ban, but it was a straw on request law, where it's like if you go to a restaurant, you have to ask them for a straw. They're not allowed to give it to you. And there was going to be the way that the initial bill was written, there was going to be like a $1,000 fine for handing out the straw. And in the press release from the legislator, it said that Americans use 500 million straws a day. And I was just like, that doesn't really make any sense, right? That's like almost two straws per person. Surely not, right? I don't use any straws a day, right? Mm-hmm. And so I just like started, like, you just like go through the rabbit hole of like, where did this source come from? It's just like all these articles referencing each other. And eventually, like, the National Park Service, said that they got it from a recycling company, and I called the recycling company. I'm like, where is this figure from? And like, it's from Milo. I'm like, who's Milo? And it's like, Milo's this 9-year-old boy who did like a anti-straw, you know, experiment where he called around manufacturers and asked them, like, you know, how many straws do you make a day? And then just averaged it together. The real number was much lower, you know, because I talked to actual analysts. And I actually talked to Milo too. I got in touch with him for my story. I asked him, I was like, do you support straw bans? He's like, no, it's just like the government telling you what to do. Yeah, so that was
so our origin stories are, I
called someone a liar,
said a woman was a liar, and you told a kid he was dumb.
Yeah, that's right. But hey, that's what fortunes were made of back then.
Journalism.
Right? Yeah. Yeah,
you should try it sometime.
That story blew up, right?
It did.
I remember. I mean, I know yours did, but this one,
no,
I was like
too.
Quoted. Yeah, I was like mentioned in the Washington Post, the New York Times. About 18 months later, pretended they discovered this. And
the New York Times always does this.
The
people
rich
don't
get
know
richer
about it,
yeah,
but they if you they will not refer to you. They'll be like a source of a libertarian variety. Had
questions
this
the
discovery
veracity,
without saying
yeah.
They won't say the publication, they won't link to you, they won't
absolutely not,
yeah, they won't ever acknowledge. That's not just for us, that's in general. They are very reluctant to acknowledge work done by other organizations.
Yeah,
period.
Yeah. No, so that was a little frustrating, but whatever. It was off
and
to
huge
the races.
Traffic.
Yeah.
Huge traffic.
That was because that was the name of the game back then. But then,
I was the master.
I know
not
you were.
To toot my
I know
own
you
horn
were.
Of those Facebook. Titles, mm-hmm. Headlines, and that kind of, that was the era of, I was generating a lot of traffic. And then, because then it, there was some amount of blowback to it from even, you know, people who were directly libertarian, but like, why is there so much coverage of campus incidents or
what people
I'm
want.
Like, honestly, there isn't. It's just that's blowing up.
Yeah, it's just what you see.
We're not,
right?
They're
yeah.
acting mm-hmm. like all we do is write about campus incidents. I'm one person at the organization with a higher education focus who finds these stories interesting, and I do think illustrative of a changing norms toward free speech among young people, among the left, among activists. No, I wrote a book about this. I think it's worth talking about. But let us not pretend that there are 20 people at the organization all working on that. I am working on that.
Yeah.
If you're noticing it, it's because it's registering with people on Facebook. Sorry. People are reading my work.
And it's registering with you, too. Right?
It's registering with you because you're so pissed about it.
Yeah, right.
We're calling out some very specific people here who we will not name. But yeah.
Right. There's a whole other website you could go to and read all the other stories that don't have to do with campus outrage.
Yes.
That's what you
want. And let's not pretend that that's the only thing. Stories of police brutality often did very, 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 very well.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, and I think unfortunately, they did better before that became – we're now living in an era where that is such a partisan issue.
Right.
With the Black Lives Matter switch over to that being just a like progressive coded thing. Because even back when – before I worked at Reason – this is going back a long time. I worked at the Daily Caller. That's the only I was at the College Fix and the Daily Caller and then Reason.
I was a freelancer, but I wrote for the College Fix a bunch. Yeah.
A great formative site for me and a lot of other young journalists.
A lot of how people get their stories.
As was the Daily Caller and is, frankly. This was a different era. This was – Tucker was still the editor of it. It was before Trump, so very long time ago. But before I did a lot of those same campus stories, and I also did constant police brutality coverage. Nobody remembers this, but this is one of the reasons I came to the attention of Reason, is that, like, oh, here's someone at a conservative media – so I'd already been an intern, but he does the conservative-coded campus stuff and also police brutality stuff. The police brutality stuff was popping for the Daily Caller, a very to-the-right website. It was just as to-the-right then as it was today. But that wasn't liberal coded,
right.
Which was a healthier time, unfortunately.
Right.
It's better when an issue is not explicitly
left or right,
because then you can have nuanced opinions on it.
Yeah, that's true. You can build interesting alliances or whatever. That's what I found interesting about writing about like the housing stuff is like they're like the partisan split is all over the map and depends on the state.
Let's keep it that way. Issue.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's something like advocates are like really worried about is like that this then becomes like a polarized partisan issue.
Yeah. Well, the advocates are afraid of Republicans championing their cause, right? Because these are – they want to seem cool and hip to liberals. Is that is
so,
my, you know, 10,000 feet in the air read of the situation.
I think that's true of a lot of people doing this kind of work in blue states, right? Where it's like you're pushing a free market agenda very clearly, like – libertarians and conservatives like in the ideosphere are your allies, but you're always worried about, you know, being too close or buddy buddy, or you gotta like go out of your way to criticize these people, because if it's an embarrassing friend to have when you're trying to get California legislators or New York legislators or Connecticut legislators, wherever you're based, to get on with your deregulatory platform that you don't want to call that. Yeah, the Hit and Run blog, man, that was such a strange animal. I have some nostalgia for it, because it would either be like three sentences and a block quote from someone else's blog, kind of fulfilling, like you see like the origins of Twitter in this, and maybe it was a better time with like
tweets,
the blog role.
Ezra Klein said this block quote. Well, here's what I think about this. Oh, and Rod Dreher said this about this. And
then
this,
here's a few other scattered thoughts I have.
Yeah,
this was kind of like the news feed for back in the day, just like housed on different websites, right? And I don't know. I haven't thought too much about like how if it's better that it's all.
Well, what social media now has
done.
Wait,
real quick before we get into social media, I want to say, so like it was a lot of those posts, and then there would just be like a 15,000 word article from Elizabeth Nolan Brown who just like blew the whistle on some bullshit prostitution, human trafficking bust that turned out to just be like, you know, deporting Korean massage parlor workers. Who had maybe been giving some hand jobs.
We're against that.
Yeah. Right? And that was the Hit and Run blog back in the day, right?
Good stuff.
It was pretty freewheeling. So I do miss that. But I don't know. Were we better off with, like, you can still go and see, like, if you look at, like, Marginal Revolution, the Tyler Cowen, Alex Tabarrok blog.
There's still some successful blogs out there, but
it's all basically collapsed onto social media.
Or Substack.
Or Substack.
Substack is replicating the blogging function. Social media,
but
you're right. Not the interactive. It's not
rapid.
Interactive.
Quick, shorter conversations between blogs. Yeah,
I mean, they want to make it because they, you know, Substack has a kind of Twitter feed type thing that some people do use. I just can't get into another social media feed.
Right.
I'm pretty committed to Twitter just because I'm too old to learn a new thing. they don't, it doesn't refer, like we're having these conversations on Twitter, it doesn't refer, you can't use the social media site to redirect traffic elsewhere. The social media sites, this is true on Facebook too, they figured out, why would we send you elsewhere? Our business model is to keep you on this website.
This is our product, yeah.
So now you have to have, you can still have these, but they have to all take place on the social media site. It can't be like, here's a snippet of what we're talking about. Mm-hmm. Go to reason.com to read it or go to, I mean, you can do that, obviously, but you won't experience massive success the way you truly used to experience success.
Social media went from being a distributor for our product to a competitor to our product, right?
Yes, to some degree.
Yeah, and is now kind of just like swallowing more and more people's like.
Which is frankly way worse for, not for Reason in particular, but for
well, what it did
giant
is
for-profit companies, like they had their distribution and thus their actual revenue reduced substantially, and they're all trying to find out how to pivot and how to do more video because you can still on YouTube we've experienced success. This is a new video product we're trying that's experiencing some success. We can do that, and actually us being a more not exactly slim, just a more adaptive and not a giant faceless company that has to decide how to, keep profits at whatever percentage. We're just like, hey, let's try out video. You feel like trying out video? I mean, that's how we pitched this show. Mm-hmm. I was like, Christian's and I are really, we had this funny banter that everyone in the office loves so much and they just hang on our every word. They just want more of it.
They can't get enough of it. You know, when we're bantering, everyone has to leave the room because they're laughing too hard.
I know, they're laughing too hard. They appreciate how inappropriate it is. Mm-hmm. They love having to talk to HR about us so much. Yeah. So I was like, you know what? Let's do it on video.
Let's do it live on air.
And then, after, we overcame the objections like, dear God, this is a bad idea.
What on earth do you think you're doing?
Who are you? And, do your jobs. You're fired. Those kinds of things. We got to have a podcast very soon.
Yeah, all you got to do is cry. And then they'll give you what you want. it's funny. Like, here's a good example of how media has changed. I wrote something this morning before I came here about the latest Alex Pretty video. I was like, I wanted to have my say on the website.
Yeah, that's your mark.
But then I was like, oh man, I really got to get to the studio to tape this because if we get this video up sooner, maybe we'll get it'll be get some more views.
A minute lost is 10,000 views squandered was the old way of thinking.
Yeah, right, exactly. But it's like, so I say that because it's like this is how we used to feel about written articles on the website. And now it's obviously the attention and the eyeballs has gone to video and what will, I assume, end up being clipped video of a longer conversation. Like, that's the source of traffic now. And that's where a lot of the resources are shifting. But yeah, this is a nice thing about being a nonprofit and one that is dedicated to timeless principles is we can experiment with things. We obviously want more attention and people to see our ideas and view our ideas. But also we can also produce a product that is of high interest to a selective, enthusiastic group of libertarians too. We didn't, this is why the BuzzFeeds and I mean Vox has gone through some changes, but like the BuzzFeeds and who's another good digital media outlet? Huffington Post. And this is where they all crashed and burned on the rock of Facebook traffic. That was,
it exploded like that watermelon. Put a bunch of rubber bands around to see how many it would take to make it explode in the most successful BuzzFeed video, live video streamed on Facebook or something. It like broke the internet in terms of the amount of simultaneously views it had for it. Mm-hmm. And then if you read, what's his name, Ben Smith's book about this period in time traffic, it's really good. He's like, Facebook learned from that. They said, oh, but wait, why do we need BuzzFeed for this?
Yeah.
We can just have the video on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
You can cut out the middlemen.
Yeah.
The middlemen were cut out. Now Facebook uses AI to generate listicles and things that you don't need to do. But
there is,
in a way, the silver lining for us is that it freed, now this era being over, frees us to write things. It's almost a burden off your shoulders. Like, I read a once a week newsletter that I hope everyone subscribes to. You do too. And I put in some effort into it because it's a snappy piece of writing that I'm proud of that I wasn't just trying to rush out, do the bare minimum, slap a Facebookable headline on it. It's it's something I'm proud of. And
that's there's a division of labor happening with social media. It's like, you know, the people who want to watch TikTok can go watch TikTok, and the people who write can write for people who want to read.
Yeah. We're putting a lot of effort into the things we write, and on our video things, we're just kind of
zero
effort.
Cody's putting in effort. We are not putting effort. Yeah, Cody is putting in he's doing the Lord's work.
Having the conversation we were going to have over beers later anyway.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right.
Well, I don't know what's in your coffee mug.
Coffee. It's early in the day still.
Is that it?
Yeah, I think that's about it. I think let's call it. I had some other things, but you know what? They'll save till next week.
Okay. Very good.
We'll be back then. Thanks for watching. See you later.